The New Testament reading this morning comes from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 22, verses 34 through 40. This is Jesus' summary of the law. Hear the word of the Lord. When the Pharisees heard that he had silenced the Sadducees, they gathered together, and one of them, a lawyer, asked him a question to test him. "Teacher, which commandment in the law is the greatest?" He said to him, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the greatest and first commandment, and a second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets." This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. There was a commercial several years ago on TV that I think is one of the funniest commercials ever made. It's a little bit old, but it's still pretty funny. It starts with a guy in a shirt and tie walking out of an office break room, and he's got a cup of coffee in his hand, and he's kind of blowing it so that the coffee will cool off. And as soon as he steps out of the break room, he's absolutely hammered by a guy coming down the hallway in a football uniform. And the football player, when he's knocked down, he leans over him with his finger in his face and says, "Break time was over 15 minutes ago, Mitch." And we're introduced to Terry Tate, office linebacker. The office linebacker's job is to roam the halls of the workplace looking for people who break the rules. When he finds them, he tackles them and gets in their face and offers them a little corrective discipline. In another scene, the office linebacker is leaning over a guy who's sprawled out on the floor, papers everywhere as a result of the collision, shouting at him, "You know you need a cover sheet on your TPS reports, Richard," while pausing to say hello to the woman walking by. "Hi, Janice." It's a pretty funny commercial. Then there's the poor guy who is playing solitaire on his computer. "You want to play games, Gene?" Terry Tate said. "Well, when it's game time, it's pain time, baby." It didn't matter. If you broke a rule, no matter who you were, Terry Tate, office linebacker, would hunt you down and make you pay. A bit violent, perhaps, but still pretty funny. What's not funny is that there are a lot of people in the world, maybe some here today, who have a picture of God in their minds that is not too far off from a cosmic version of Terry Tate, office linebacker. This is a view that pictures God as just waiting for us to make a mistake so that he can punish us and drive us into submission. When we think of God this way, it changes our understanding of the covenant that God makes with the children of Israel in giving them the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai. Instead of a covenant of grace, we look at it as a covenant that promises condemnation and instills fear. When we think of God in this way, the Ten Commandments become merely a weapon of negative enforcement, a way to measure how deserving we are of what Martin Luther called the hammer of judgment. A report card whose only purpose is to show us how far we have fallen short. A warning that disobedience is fully expected and will be punished. When we think of God in this way, we come to believe that God's law, given to us in the Ten Commandments, is designed to condemn and to belittle us. And when we think of God and God's law in this way, it creates in us a hatred for ourselves because we know we can never measure up. And then by default, a hatred for the one who gave us the law in the first place. In other words, when we think of God this way, instead of a gift of God's goodness and grace, God's law becomes a barrier, an obstacle, something that stands between us and God. The problem is that is not the God we find revealed in Scripture. That's not the God that we have spent the last several months getting to know by working our way through Genesis and Exodus, is it? Is that the God of Jacob, the God who stayed with Jacob even after he tricked his brother Esau into selling him his birthright? Or the God who, after Jacob fled because he deceived his father Isaac into giving him the blessing, tracked Jacob down and promised him that he would be with him and would keep him wherever he went and would bring him home? I don't think that's office linebacker type behavior. Is that the God of Joseph, who gave Joseph the grace to forgive his brothers after they had flung him into a pit and sold him as a slave to Egypt? Or the God who caused Joseph to rise in power in Egypt, providing a way for the family to survive famine in Canaan, leading Joseph to say to his brothers, "What you intended for evil, God meant and used for good." Is that the God of Moses, who did not come down and smite Moses after he had killed an Egyptian, but appeared to him in a burning bush and told him that he had heard the cry of the Hebrews, his people, and that he was going to send Moses to Pharaoh to lead his people out of Egypt? No, we have not come to know a God who in any way resembles the hard and punishing and unforgiving Terry Tate, office linebacker. This God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph, this God of Moses, is a God who makes a covenant with the Hebrew people and saves them, literally saves them from certain death at the hand of the Egyptians. It is only after God rescues them from the Egyptians, after he brought them out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, that he gives them these famous laws that we read today. There are probably a lot of people here who have memorized these Ten Commandments. Maybe you learned them as a child. Maybe you're younger. Maybe you started to learn them earlier this year when Krista did the children's sermons with the hand gestures to help us remember. But if we're called upon to name the Ten Commandments, what do we usually start with? "You shall have no other gods before me." That skips something very important, doesn't it? I'm so thankful that when Barb made these beautiful banners, that she started not with "You shall have no other gods before me," but "I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the house of slavery." It's as if to say, this is who I was before I gave you these commandments, and this is who I am as I give you these commandments. It's very important that this introduction comes first. Grace first, and then law. Churches in the Reformed tradition, and Presbyterians are Reformed, tend to emphasize this by placing the reading of the law in a particular point in the worship service. Now, as you know, we at Parkwood don't every week have the reading of the law in worship, but we have done it at times before. Those of you who were here during Lent earlier this year may remember when we did this. For those 6 weeks, we read these laws after the confession of sin and assurance of pardon. And we put it at that point in the worship service to emphasize this. We do not follow the law in order to be saved. We follow the law because God has rescued us from sin. The law is to guide and direct our lives of gratitude. We are to obey the law, not so that we might be saved, but because we are saved, we are freed to live as we ought. And just as in Exodus 20, at the base of Mount Sinai, before the people are given the law, they are told what God has already done on their behalf. I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Now, all of this is not to minimize the importance of the law. What we do matters. What we do is what we become. We should know these commandments. Most people, even professing Christians, if pressed, can't name more than a few. But we should know them, and we should strive to follow them. But if we are not clinging to the law out of fear, fearful that we might need it if we were to ever face a cosmic office linebacker, and yet it's still very important, what purpose then does the law serve? I think it's helpful to think of the law for what it is, a gift. It's not a checklist for gaining God's favor, but a description of what it will be like to live as God's people. We can clearly see our own failings in light of God's law, but instead of driving us to despair, God's law provides a corrective for us. Instead of causing us to cower in fear, it refocuses us on God. And as it does so, it provides a way for God's love and mercy to shine in our lives. Because the God who calls us to follow his commands is the God who saved us from our sin. It's a gift that works in two ways. First, it shows God's love for us. It shows us how to flourish as God's beloved children in the same way that God heard the cry of his beloved people in bondage in Egypt and set them free from slavery. So too does God set us free from slavery to the things that would enslave us. God knows what behaviors will lead to destruction and despair in our own lives and in the lives of our community. And God knows what behaviors will lead us to flourish. In the gift of the law, God gives us the shape of the transformed life, the happy life, the blessed life, the delightful life. Psalm 1 puts this beautifully. Happy are those who do not follow the advice of the wicked, or take the path that sinners tread, or sit in the seat of scoffers. But their delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law they meditate day and night. The law itself does not transform us, but after God has dealt with our sin, God's law shows us the shape of a transformed life. Any of us who are parents know how dearly we want our children to make good and life-giving choices in their lives because of the love that we have for them. So too does God, our heavenly parent, out of his great love for us, gives us his law so that we might be led toward choices that will be good and life-giving for us. The second way that the law functions as a gift is to help us show our love for God. The first way God expresses God's love for us, and the second way gives us a way to express our love for God. We who have been saved yearn to please God. We obey not because we fear punishment, but because we want to show our love for the one who redeemed us. We want to live our lives in gratitude for all that God has done for us. When you love someone, don't you want to please them? Think about the gift giving that you do at Christmas time. Sometimes there are people on your list that you love dearly, but you just can't figure out what to get them. You don't know what will please them necessarily or bring them joy. But God is like those people on your list where it's so easy to figure out what they would cherish. In the law, God lets us know what pleases Him. God's gift to us of the law shows us how we can express our love and thanksgiving for God by living according to His commands. The bottom line is that the law finds its proper use, its greatest expression in hearts that are swept up and carried away by their love for God. It's worth noting that when Jesus gives His summary of the whole law, which we read this morning, He does not begin it by saying, "You shall fear the Lord your God. You better not disobey the Lord your God. Or you shall submit to the Lord your God." Jesus says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul, mind and strength, and your neighbor as yourself." God, in His love for us, gives us the gift of His law to guide and to protect us. And our love for God echoes forth in response, and we joyfully and thankfully seek to honor and please this God who has done so much for us. God's law is not about burdens or obligations or threats, because God is not like a cosmic office linebacker looking for reasons to unload on us. God's law is about the love of a God who called us and claimed us as His own. Thanks be to God.